All right, so my name is Aaron Bohannon, and I'm going to be presenting some work I did with my advisor, Benjamin Pierce. Now, you're probably thinking that the introduction of this talk is going to be the easy part where you won't have to think too hard. But I've decided to prepare a little quiz to get us thinking about web scripting. I've prepared three questions that I did not know the answer to when I started working on this project, but there's a lot of expertise in web scripting out here, so maybe you guys will know the answers. So the first question, let's assume we have a JavaScript document object D, and we use it to create a new DOM element that we assigned E. And now, let's assume that D and E remain unchanged from this point on. Now, the element E is going to have a property called owner document. And when E is created, it's going to be set to D. Now, can this property ever be changed? It's actually a read-only property, but it turns out that it can end up being set to a different document. And this would happen if a script took the element E and put it in a different document in the browser. There's nothing that prevents nodes from moving from one document to another. And this is why conceptually browsers need one global heap for DOM nodes rather than one per page. Now, a very special kind of DOM node is a script node. And when you insert a script node in a document, it can cause a script to be run. But there are a lot of corner cases involving this operation. So what would happen if you remove a script node from a document and insert it somewhere else, perhaps in the same document, perhaps in a different document? Or what would happen if you take the text out of a script node and put some different text in there? Is that script going to be run? What would happen if you reassign a value to the source attribute of a script node? Are all of these going to trigger a new script to be run? Or perhaps none of these? And the answer is none of these, because script nodes have a flag associated with them that indicates whether they've been scheduled for execution. And once they've been scheduled for execution, there's nothing you can do to manipulate the script node to trigger the script to be run again. Now, I've saved the trickiest question for last here. Can a handler always get a reference to the window, let's say a button click handler, always get a reference to the window in which the user clicked? Now you're probably thinking, sure, we can just use the expression self, or equivalently window if you're more familiar with that. Well, this is not completely true, actually. Because self is statically scoped to refer to the window in which it is used. So if, let's say, the function that's used as the handler for a button was defined in a different window, then self is going to be referring to the window where the function is defined, not the window where the button lives. Okay, but surely there has to be some way to get a reference to the window that the user clicked. Well, in JavaScript, handlers are passed an event object. From the event object, you can get a reference to the button node, and the button node has an owner document. And from the document, you can get the window that the document is lives in. So this seems like a pretty foolproof way for a handler to get a reference to the window that the user clicked in. But what if this was one of several handlers, and it was not the first handler that got run for the button? And what if the previous handler actually moved the button to a different window? Well, then that strategy would no longer give you the window in which the button was when it was clicked. So I don't know. Maybe someone out there knows some other tricky way to get a reference to the window. As far as I know, this statement would have to be false. So my background is in programming language semantics, and I find the semantics of web scripts to be a little peculiar, but also fascinating. And there's several things I find interesting about this, the semantics of web scripts, which, first of all, web scripts are manipulating browser structures that are tied together in some complex ways. Second, web scripts are all triggered by events, you know, user inputs or network responses. So this plays into the semantics. And then in languages like JavaScript, we have interesting features like first-class functions and dynamic evaluation. So I'm interested in formalizing the behavior of web scripts and web browsers. And why do I want to do this? Well, ultimately, we're interested in doing a rigorous analysis of information security policies for web browsers. And that would be things like the same origin policy. Now, in order to do a rigorous study, say involving formal proofs, you would need a rigorous definition of a web browser security policy. And in order to get a completely rigorous definition of a security policy, you would really need a rigorous definition of the semantics of what's going on in a web browser. Now, of course, in order to do some formal proofs about this stuff, there has to be some kind of simplifications or abstractions. One could use the source code for a web browser as a formal specification, but that's not tractable to do formal proofs about. And that's what we're interested in. So when we sat down to write this model, we wanted to abstract away from certain details, such as parsing and document rendering and some of the details of the network, like DNS. Another choice was that we wanted to make this semantics deterministic. And for the most part, browsers do operate deterministically. After they receive an input, they process it until they're finished. And there's only a few corner cases where you can observe non-determinism in a web script. We were interested in the semantics of how scripts manipulate browser data structures, but the entire JavaScript language is quite complex, and other people have studied that on its own. So what we ended up doing was defining a small language that bears some similarity to JavaScript, but doesn't include any features of any of the object-oriented features of JavaScript, which is where a lot of the complexity comes from. And finally, we are interested in using this as a platform for exploring different security policies. So we built this formal semantics without any security restrictions of any kind. So in a nutshell, what have we built here? We've written down a formal semantics for web browsers and web scripts. And it includes many key features of web browsers. I'll mention the ones we've included in a minute. We've defined it in a small step style, which is different from what other people have tried to do in the past. And this is important for accurately representing the incremental output that the browser produces as it executes. We've defined it essentially using logical inference rules, which are standard in giving an operational semantics to programming languages. However, instead of writing them down on paper, we wrote them down in the OCaml language, and the type system of OCaml gives us some basic sanity checks as far as, you know, preventing some kind of some certain types of typos and such. So the features that we covered with our semantics include multiple browser windows that contain multiple pages over their lifetime. It includes document node trees that are updatable in arbitrary ways, buttons and text boxes that the user can interact with, network requests and responses with cookies, and scripts with first-class functions, dynamic evaluation, and AJAX capabilities. So I think of these as kind of the core features of what a web browser does. There are a lot of features we had to leave out, though. And for our goals of studying information security properties, I think these five features are the most interesting ones that we did not have time or resources to actually put in. And if I have more time to work on this project, these are the ones that are that I would like to add. So before I go on and give you more details about what we've done, I want to touch on the related work in the area. So there are a lot of web standards out there. None of them really describe what a web browser does in detail until HTML5 came along. And most of us think of HTML5 as a bunch of new features, but actually it's a very large document that is one of the first detailed specifications of what a web browser is supposed to do. Unfortunately, it's written in English, and that makes it hard to do formal proofs about the specification. So at the other end of the spectrum, there was this paper in Popple in 2007, and these people were also interested in studying security for JavaScript, and they defined a very, very small model of a web browser and a web scripting language, and I mean very tiny. So this all fit on one page, you know, but it was completely formal. It just didn't have many features at all. Then there was another paper. Yoshihama and colleagues took the semantics in the Popple paper and tried to extend it with a lot of features, the sort of features that we've considered. However, they didn't take the features and the semantics they gave was not really complete or formal enough to do formal proofs with. And so I read the paper and thought to myself, what would it take to fill in all of the details of how all of these features really work together? And that's where I came up with this formal semantics that we've developed. And it was quite amazing how much work it was to fill in all these details. There have been a few other noteworthy formalizations for various pieces of a browser. People have looked at formalizing JavaScript semantics for JavaScript on its own without regard to the browser interaction. And there people have looked at the DOM interface in particular. And another recent paper looked at some client-server interactions and the web platform as a whole. So I'm going to give you a few details about how our model of the browser works, and then I'll wrap up. So the first thing we had to address is how to accurately address the event-driven nature of web browsers. And so we came up with this very simple concept of we call a reactive system. It's just a simple state machine where the states are divided into two disjoint sets. We have one set called consumer states and the other called producer states. And in a consumer state, the system is waiting for an input. And when it receives an input, it will step to some producer state. And from then, it acts autonomously. It can step to another state on its own. And in doing so, it will produce an output. Now, it can come back to a producer state indefinitely, but it may eventually step back to a consumer state, at which point it's waiting for another input. So this is the basic framework in which we want a browser to fit. And in order to tell you what we've done, I need to describe what these states look like in a web browser, and then also what the inputs and outputs look like. So I'm going to start by explaining what a browser state looks like. And the consumer state is the one that's waiting for input. Here we have basically six core pieces of information. So we have a store or a heap of windows mapping window references to window data structures. We have a store of pages mapping page references to page data structures, a store of document nodes. We have a store of activation records, which provide the environment for scripts that are executed. Of course, we have a store of cookies. And then we have a list of outstanding network connections. And I'll come back and describe that in a second. So I'm just going to describe a couple pieces here. I'm sorry. So that was a consumer state. And then the producer state looks very similar when the browser is working. The browser just it needs all the same information plus a list of tasks, which are scripts that it's in the middle of executing. So as I said, the window store maps window references to window data structures. And the window data structures are actually very simple in our model. Windows can have names, which is an optional string. They can have an opener, which is an optional reference to another window. And most importantly, they have a page that they're containing at this particular moment in time. So their windows are basically just a way of indirectly referring to a page. And what is a page? Well, this has more interesting information. It has the URL of representing its contents. It has a root node, which is the root node of the document in the page. And it has an environment, which is the global environment for any scripts that are run in the page. It has one more thing, which is a queue of scripts that it needs to execute, but I don't have time to go into the details of how that works right now. The list of open network connections is interesting because it's not a part of the browser that you can directly access through the scripting language, but it's very important. Whenever the browser makes an HTTP request, it needs to remember that it made it and keep some information so that it knows what to do when it receives the corresponding response. So, for instance, if it requests a document, then it will need to remember a reference to the window in which the document is supposed to be placed. When it makes a script request generated by a script node, it needs to remember which node requested that. And then the AJAX requests, of course, need to be handled differently. The browser needs to remember which page the AJAX request was made from, and also keep a script expression that will be used as the handler when the AJAX response is received. So that covers briefly an overview of some parts of the state. Now, the inputs and outputs, what we've done is represent these with very simple syntactic messages. Now, a reactive system has one kind of input, but in reality, in the browser, there are inputs that come from the network and inputs that come from the user. And these are all going to be interleaved. You won't know. They all arrive together and are sequenced into some order. What sorts of things can the user do? This is just two of this half a dozen or so that we have in our model. But you know, the user can open a page to a new URL, or the user can click on a button, for instance. The network only has one kind of input. There's only one kind of thing you can get from the network, which is an HTTP response. and the information associated with the HTTP response includes the domain. That's what D represents here. It also includes a number N, because if the browser makes multiple requests to a single domain, it needs to know which response matches with which request. And this is, of course, in reality handled by the underlying network layer, but it has to be represented somehow in our semantics to have a correct matchup here between requests and responses. And the third piece of information is the actual body of the response. The other thing we have yet to discuss is the outputs. So there are a couple outputs that represent user interface updates, and these are just two of the ones we've defined. There's only one kind of output to the network. Again, we don't make any distinction between GET requests and POST requests in this model. So there's only one kind of request. And D, again, is a domain. The request URI is a part of the URL after the domain. Then there's cookies, and the message is going to be empty if it's a GET request. If it's a POST request, this would be the body of the message. So where do we go from here? A lot of people are interested in knowing, you know, how can they get use out of what we've done here? So I would say primarily I view this, our formal semantics, as a human readable template, so that if someone else wants to sit down and do some formal proofs or study security policies formally, they can look at what we've done and adapt it to their needs. It's very likely other people will be interested in different kinds of features, and it should be fairly easy to take what we've done and adapt it. It's written in OCaml, and that's okay if you want to do pen and paper proofs, but if you want to do some model checking or something like that, it might have to be translated to a different language. In fact, the first thing that we're doing with it is translating it to the Coq proof assistant, because we would like to actually do mechanized proofs about this model. And we found this translation to be quite straightforward. So it hasn't, you know, it's easy to take what we've done and translate it to a different form. Further down the road, what we'd like to do is define security policies for this model of a browser in terms of a notion of non-interference on reactive systems that we've investigated and presented at CCS. And after we define some particular policy, we want to define some mechanism that enforces the policy and then prove that this mechanism is sound. And so we see this as a platform for exploring the design space of various security policies and various security mechanisms for web browsers. And ultimately, we hope to eventually gain a much deeper understanding of the end-to-end security properties for web browsers. Thank you.
Howdy. James Makes Microsoft Research. So one question I have for you is, do you think that the, you know, who's the target audience for this? Is it mainly browser developers or application developers? And the reason that I ask is because, you know, in the operating systems community, you know, sometimes people ask questions like, well, how does the page cache work? And the answer is inevitably, oh, we don't really know. And so, you know, trying to tune your stuff for the page cache often involves sort of like this empirical component. What do OSs often do in practice? And in my personal experience in doing some pretty heavyweight JavaScript applications, it's often this empirical experience too. You know, I mean, the browser spec can say one thing, but what the browsers actually do is often much, much different. So, you know, is your tool and your formalism mainly designed for browser developers to say, you know, this is the way we should design browsers in the future? Or can I, as an application developer, take anything from this work?
So it would really be more appropriate for browser developers. And even there, I think that what we're doing is not something that's going to be useful immediately for browser developers, but it's really a theoretical model of a browser that we can use to gain some insight and, 5 or 10 years down the road, understand better about how security works in web browsers.
Ask you a question that I thought about as I was reading this paper. So you've given us a framework, and I see that you want to head toward the direction of being able to automatically prove some things. But just on the basis of your framework, have you come up with any pen and paper or even whiteboard sketches? Has your framework sort of pointed you toward particular flaws where you said, oh, this is a bogus part of the browser, or this is a part of the browser that's so ill-defined that it's a disaster? Or kind of what sort of lessons did you learn in the process of trying to write down what the heck browsers do?
So, yes, I mean, for instance, I mentioned non-determinism. The one case where I know browsers behave non-deterministically is a script in one window is usually executed concurrently with parsing and rendering a document in another window, but there's nothing stopping the script from interacting with the document while it's being rendered, so it's really impossible to say what you're going to find when you try to access that window. And I'm really surprised that there's not some kind of locking mechanism, and in fact there's no way for the script to even know when the parsing in one window is finished. At least, there are some hacks in, say, Firefox to do something like that. But it would be interesting to actually see that kind of thing standardized.
One more question for you. You said you've used a small step semantics and contrasted it with other approaches. You also mentioned the HTML5 spec, which uses a long English paragraph semantics. are there other approaches in between the two that you've seen, and what's wrong, and what is inadequate about them?
Yes, I didn't explain that very well. In programming language semantics, we generally a big step semantics considers evaluation as happening in one big step, from start to end. And the problem with that is that it doesn't give you a good representation of what happens if there's outputs being generated along the way, or if there's an error at some point. All you know is there was an error. You don't know what happened before the error or what didn't happen after the error.